inquiring next how that which is equivocal can be distinguished from the truth, whether in life or in language, for in both are elements of the false mingled with the true. It is my opinion that the wise man has not withdrawn himself, as Posidonius thinks, from those arts which we were discussing, but that he never took them up at all. For he would have judged that nothing was worth discovering, that he would not afterwards judge to be worth using always. He would not take up things which would have to be laid aside. But Anacharsis, says Posidonius, invented the potter's wheel, whose whirling gives shape to vessels. Then, because the potter's wheel is mentioned in Homer, people prefer to believe that Homer's verses are false rather than the story of Posidonius. But I maintain that Anacharsis was not the creator of this wheel. And, even if he was, although he was a wise man when he invented it, yet he did not invent it qua wise man. Just as there are a great many things which wise men do as men, not as wise men. Suppose, for example, that a wise man is exceedingly fleet of foot. He will outstrip all the runners in the race by virtue of being fleet, not by virtue of his wisdom. I should like to show Posidonius, some glass blower, who by his breath molds the glass into manifold shapes, which could scarcely be fashioned by the most skillful hand. Nay, these discoveries have been made since we men have ceased to discover wisdom. But Posidonius again remarks, Democritus is said to have discovered the arch, whose effect was that the curving line of stones, which gradually lean toward each other, is bound together by the keystone. I am inclined to pronounce this statement false, for there must have been, before Democritus, bridges and gateways in which the curvature did not begin until about the top. It seems to have quite slipped your memory that this same Democritus discovered how ivory could be softened, how by boiling a pebble could be transformed into an emerald, the same process used even today for coloring stones, which are found to be amenable to this treatment. It may have been a wise man who discovered all such things, but he did not discover them by virtue of being a wise man, for he does many things which we see done just as well, or even more skillfully and dexterously, by men who are utterly lacking in sagacity. Do you ask what, then, the wise man has found out, and what he has brought to light? First of all, there is truth, and nature. And nature he has not followed as the other animals do, with eyes too dull to perceive the divine in it. In the second place, there is the law of life, and life he has made to conform to universal principles. And he has taught us not merely to know the gods, but to follow them, and to welcome the gifts of chance precisely as if they were divine commands. He has forbidden us to give heed to false opinions, and has weighed the value of each thing by a true standard of appraisement. He has condemned those pleasures with which remorse is intermingled, and has praised those goods which will always satisfy. And he has published the truth abroad, that he is most happy who has no need of happiness, and that he is most powerful who has power over himself. I am not speaking of that philosophy which has placed the citizen outside his country and the gods outside the universe, and which has bestowed virtue upon pleasure, but rather of that philosophy which counts nothing good except what is honorable, one which cannot be cajoled by the gifts either of man or fortune, one whose value is that it cannot be bought for any value. That this philosophy existed in such a rude age, when the arts and crafts were still unknown, and when useful things could only be learned by use, this I refuse to believe. Next there came the fortune-favored period, when the bounties of nature lay open to all for men's indiscriminate use, before avarice and luxury had broken the bonds which held mortals together, and they, abandoning their communal existence, had separated and turned to plunder. The men of the second age were not wise men, even though they did what wise men should do. Indeed, there is no other condition of the human race that anyone would regard more highly. And if God should commission a man to fashion earthly creatures and to bestow institutions upon peoples, this man would approve of no other system than that which obtained among the men of that age when no plowman tilled the soil, nor was it right to portion off or bound one's property. Men shared their gains, and earth more freely gave her riches to her sons, who sought them not. What race of men was ever more blessed than that race? They enjoyed all nature in partnership. Nature sufficed for them, now the guardian, as before she was the parent, of all. And this her gift consisted of the assured possession by each man of the common resources. Why should I not even call that race the richest among mortals, since you could not find a poor person among them? But avarice broke in upon a condition so happily ordained, and by its eagerness to lay something away and to turn it to its own private use, made all things the property of others, and reduced itself from boundless wealth to straitened need. It was avarice that introduced poverty and, by craving much,